You're listening to the Celestial Citizen Podcast, and I'm your host, Britt Duffy Adkins. Celestial Citizen is a space urban planning company looking to help build and shape a more equitable and just future for all of humanity as we become a space-faring society. This podcast seeks to provide an opportunity for conversation about how to be a better interplanetary citizen and responsible steward of Earth and the cosmos. By engaging the global public, providing greater access to the space industry, and amplifying a more diverse set of voices, progress in space can equate to progress on Earth. We, who are bursting with stardust, can become Celestial Citizens. Welcome to another episode of Celestial Citizen Podcast. Today, we'll be discussing the psychology of space travel, how the overview effect can help promote mental health, and the role that virtual reality and multi-sensory experiences will play in expanding worldviews.
Earth and Mars and Venus started their life story around the same time, and they were all at one point likely to have been planets that were habitable or with temporal conditions, good temperatures that can support life. And I think that's a remarkable story that these siblings somehow started their journey the same. Earth is the only one can cater for life as we know it.
On today's show, we are joined by Dr. Anahita Nizami. Anahita is a chartered psychologist, author, and founder of Overview Effect Therapy and Earthscape VR. She is a systems thinker advocating for positive social change and has dedicated her professional career to researching the science and therapeutic value of salutogenic experiences like the Overview Effect. Her areas of interest include space health, eco-psychology, neuroscience, stress, trauma, performance, and altered states of consciousness. Anahita serves as an advisor to multiple organizations and was elected as a fellow of the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures, and Commerce. Anahita has been invited to talk about mental health and the overview effect on BBC Radio 4 and TEDx. She is an active researcher and published papers and articles with Springer and other media outlets. The overview effect, a term coined by Frank White, describes a transcendent state that can emerge when witnessing remarkable natural landscapes from an expansive vantage point, and Earth gazing from orbit or the moon is the epitome of this experience. Several years ago, Anahita interviewed NASA astronauts to investigate the therapeutic benefits of the overview effect as part of her doctoral research. She soon realized that the experience offers comparable results to psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy and nature-based experiences in promoting eco-transcendence and eudaimonic well-being. After completing her doctoral studies, Anahita co-founded Earthscape VR, formerly VROE, where she helps create evidence-led extended reality multi-sensory experiences based on the overview effect. The XR programs can be utilized as an adjunct to psychotherapy, workshops, or as a standalone well-being tool for individuals, groups, and organizations. Anahita is now facilitating the integration of the established XR-VR component into programs for sustainable leadership, space health, and ecotherapy. A further aim is to leverage the programs to determine via empirical research, one, if they can trigger states and emotions analogous to the overview effect, and two, to investigate the potential benefits of the programs in the field of applied psychology to provide alternative solutions to current challenges in mental health, both on-world and off. And Anahita, it's great to have you on the podcast today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
So let's get started with a bit about your origin story. How did you first become interested in the intersection of space and psychology? And what was your journey to your current career path?
So originally, back in 2003, I was studying an undergraduate psychology degree. And after that, I was working in, you know, NHS, inpatient units, outpatient units, prisons, you name it, I've worked there. After that, I actually did a forensic psychology master's. It really was a point where I needed to find a new career path within psychology. Working in prisons, I realized that it wasn't the correct path for me for several reasons. One was I felt quite helpless to create meaningful change. It's quite actuarial in terms of the work that you do. And it was difficult to really do meaningful work, I found, for me. So at that point, I took a career change and moved into counseling psychology and did a doctorate in counseling psychology. And all this time, I've been working with people experiencing various mental health problems as a trainee psychologist, as a counseling psychologist, and really trying to pave out my area of interest. Alongside all of this, I've always had an interest in peak performance, in altered states of consciousness. I've always been interested in human capabilities in terms of how we can achieve the best results in human beings and what motivates and drives us to do that. And towards the end of the doctorate, you have to complete a research piece, a thesis. The research piece, I was really searching around altered states of consciousness and trying to understand more in that area. I was fascinated with various states and looking into various experiences. For example, near-death experiences, peak performance, as well as extreme sports and psychedelics. I was interested in those types of experiences. And that's when I came across the work of Frank White and found out about the overview effect. And coinciding with this, I was beginning to enter into the field of eco-psychology, which is really looking at how nature can support our well-being and the human-nature connection. So I came across this experience and I was blown away. I was very interested. It's such an extraordinary experience. It's very unique. And only a small number of people have had the opportunity to have the experience. And the more I read about it, the more I sort of learned that there were many similarities with other experiences like psychedelics, nature-based experiences people have when they go into extraordinary settings, for example, or forests. From there, I thought this could be an interesting area to try to learn more about the phenomenology of the experience. And I wasn't sure if I could, you know, gain any participants, which would be astronauts for people who don't know what the overview effect is. So at that point, I reached out to Frank White to see if we could arrange some sort of interviews with astronauts to tell him my ideas. And he was very forthcoming and very interested in doing more research in this area. And after a few meetings with him, he kindly agreed to put me in touch with some former NASA astronauts, retired NASA astronauts. After sort of arranging the actual methodology of the research in terms of how we were going to research this area and what the hypothesis was and what we were going to be doing, then I started talking to astronauts. And really the basis of that was to try to find out the therapeutic value of the overview effect. So usually with research that has not been covered in great length, it can be a good idea to carry out some qualitative work to try to find out some of the characteristics of the quality of the experience. And so really trying to find out if there are any unifying themes, if there's anything that stands out, so that you can explore it further and then other researchers can build on your work from there, as well as yourself, hopefully, if you carry out more research. So building on Frank White's work and other people after him and before him, like Nick Canis as well, who's a space psychologist who's interested also in the overview effect and salutogenic experiences, I explored the themes that were coming up in what the astronauts were saying. It might be worth me explaining at this point what the overview effect is for those of you in your audience that aren't aware. So the overview effect refers to the first-hand experience that astronauts and cosmonauts have when they go into orbit or on moon landings, and when they see planet Earth from that perspective, and they report back experiencing feelings like awe, compassion, but also a deep connection with nature and planet Earth. And many of the astronauts and cosmonauts that return also come back and follow humanitarian pursuits as well as pro-environmental campaigns and pursuits. And so this experience has been termed under the umbrella of the overview effect. And so I wanted to explore this experience in more detail.
Fantastic. Frank White has actually been on the podcast kind of chatting about the overview effect. And we talk about it a fair amount here on the podcast as well, because it is amazing how the overview effect and this theory and or you know concept of impact that it has in terms of shifting people's worldview, it's really inspired a lot of people in the space community in the work that they do in many different capacities. Now, what's really interesting, I think, about the work that you do in particular is that actually I remember when Frank was on, we kind of talked about the fact that not everybody actually experiences the overview effect. Like sometimes it doesn't occur, which is interesting too. But my question for you is, you talk about the connection between awe and connection to nature and mental health. Is this always an inherently positive relationship? Or actually, do you ever find any instances in which the overview effect or that overwhelming sense of awe leads to any sort of negative feelings in people that you have studied or talked to?
We have a very small population to actually examine this experience. There's only 630 people or around that number that have gone to see space and to see planet Earth from the distant vantage point. So it's very difficult to make too broader generalizations at this stage. So we have to be cautious about that. So at this stage, I think after the Apollo missions, adverse responses to spaceflight have been very few. Everyone's been generally very positive about their spaceflight experience all in all. And so that extends out even more so to the experience of seeing planet Earth from space. So in relation to the astronauts, no, the people we've spoken to, largely it has been very positive seeing planet Earth. Planet Earth is the grounding experience for them. You know, they're in a semi-sterile mechanical environment and they have space all around them. And they have also planet Earth in front of them. That is home. That is where they belong. So it's a positive experience for them to see Earth in that way. And the reports have been very positive. I do suspect that later on, when we go further afield, that there may be changes as, for example, with planned trips to Mars, as Earth becomes smaller and smaller until a point where it's the size of a disk. I think that can have potentially a more negative impact on spacefarers. I think also in terms of there is something called the ultraview effect by Dina Wiebel, I think her name is. And that talks about the impact of seeing the vast cosmos before you and how that can affect a human being, the human psyche. We are very terrestrial citizens, tribal in nature, and we are local. You know, everything is based on local interactions, although, of course, we have the internet, we have global communication. But generally, in terms of our evolution, that's how we operate. So being faced with such an expansive scene, I think, can derail us, potentially not astronauts and cosmonauts who are very, you know, they're trained and the right stuff and all of that. But for most people, I think that could be derailing, particularly if you're in that environment for a long time. So there is that side of it in terms of that sort of expansiveness of the scene and being very unfamiliar with the scene and really engaging perceptually with an environment that you're not used to, your body's not used to, your mind's not used to, your senses aren't used to. And how you adjust to that could give rise to some destabilization or disturbances from a psychological perspective. In relation to awe specifically, because of course we can experience awe here on Earth and it's something that is quite accessible for us to experience in day-to-day encounters that we have, as well as the extraordinary. So awe is pretty accessible emotion for most people. And again, awe is really coupled with this sense of self-expansion that you feel. It's an intense emotion. It doesn't last a very long time, but it's a very intense state to experience. And so largely it's a positive experience. But for example, if you have some heart conditions or if you have certain predisposition to anxiety, that can also be destabilizing. Or if you're uncomfortable with an increase in heart rate, all of these things, it can be destabilizing. but it has lots of positive benefits in terms of helping us connect, feel connected to the world. It helps us feel more enchanted, to re-enchant you with the world around you, as well as things like physiological health benefits. So we now know that through recent sort of research that all can reduce inflammation, for example. There's a few research papers that found that, but it makes sense in terms of how our emotions can affect our physiological states. And we've known that for a long time. And of course, awe is a powerful emotion. So it makes sense that some of the hormones or some of the biochemical responses in the body that are activated may have results as well. So it's a very powerful emotion. And I think in terms of psychology, we want to look into these emotions to see how we can use them in clever ways, how we can elicit them, use them, teach people, train them to elicit them within themselves, to then try to help them heal, try to help them regulate themselves, try to help them access these emotions more at will. And I think that's why the overview effect is particularly interesting, as a contextually we can use these scenes and couple them with other powerful things like music and meditation to try to elicit certain responses in people in order to support them and help them.
This sense of awe that individuals might feel in space, does it dampen at some point? Like, let's say you're in space for 3 months aboard the ISS, something of that nature, right? Is that something that's an initial reaction, or does the human's like psychology remain in this 3 month extended period of awe? And then as a follow-up to that, what is the physiological change to the human body that occurs based on that extended period of experiencing the overview effect or experiencing that sense of awe?
In terms of awe is a fleeting state. So if you lived in a state of awe continuously, I'm not sure if that's possible or if that would be viable or even recommended. And but also in terms of when the astronauts are going up and having their experience, it's not a continuous awe state that they're having. There are moments that they capture that feeling, perhaps in moments of contemplation or reflection. But awe is a great motivator for social change, for pro-social behavior. So you may only experience it in a moment, but it can have lasting effects in terms of behavior and in terms of how you respond later on. And of course, again, it's something that if we experience it regularly enough, we can program ourselves to access it more freely and more easily. So in that sense, it's very important. And it's also an emotion that can really distract us from the small self. So I'm talking about on terrestrial settings, we're tied up with day-to-day activities, we're busy, we might have family, we might have kids, we have work, we have jobs. So awe is something that can really take us out of that, the daily struggles that we're experiencing. And that's even more so important, I think, for astronauts and cosmonauts, particularly if on the longer term missions, you know, the Artemis missions, where others are talking about moon villages or Martian habitats or Venus habitats. And I think on these longer term missions, we really need to think about the well-being ecosystems that we're implementing, because the standard well-being ecosystems that we have now on the ISS will need to be extended, will need to be developed. And so I think programs that can tap into awe states, again, combining different methods, perhaps it could be restoration using nature, it could be music, meditation, it can be VR experiences. I think they can be a very powerful source of regulation, restoration, as well as some healthy escapism, especially for these longer term deep space missions. But in terms of the physiology of awe, I think you would need to talk to probably more of a medical doctor rather than a counseling psychologist to identify that. But, you know, I think it could reduce cortisol levels in the body. And I think in terms of brain regions that are activated, I think it can, for example, interfere with the default mode network, which has been associated with depression, for example. Default mode network is a series of regions in the brain that are activated, and it links to dream states, but also to rumination and overthinking and those types of stressful thought patterns. So if we can use not just awe, but awe as a basis of some of these programs, I think that it could have a viable sort of area to investigate how we can support people in extreme environments like deep space and extraterrestrial environments as well.
And now a quick word from our gold sponsor, Multiverse Media. We are currently witnessing the birth of a robust, sustainable economy within cislunar space. What is cislunar space? Well, it's the part of space that ranges from low Earth orbit out to geostationary orbit, and then beyond toward the moon's surface. This cislunar economy will involve a much more interconnected paradigm for space development. For a snapshot and user guide to the players and opportunities ahead, New Space Global, a Multiverse Media property, has produced a report titled Cislunar Market Opportunities. To get your copy, please go to cislunar.report and use coupon code CITIZEN10 for 10% off a single user license. Thank you again to Multiverse Media for sponsoring Celestial Citizen this year. Now, back to the show. How does the work that you are doing at Earthscape VR fit into all of this? And how can experiencing virtual reality really yield a comparable experience to the overview effect?
On Earth, we have access to beautiful scenes of nature, and we can go for a walk in a park. We can feel the breeze on our face. For most of us, we have access to water. We can eat food that we choose. Our senses are activated and engaged a lot. And, you know, we won't have wonderful things when we're on deep space missions. And so I think nature-based applications in virtual reality, extended reality, all of these kinds of technologies are going to be very important, particularly because these vessels, when we're going out there, as it stands, we won't be able to carry much cargo and weight. So we need lightweight applications that can help the crew, people, whoever they are going out. So that's one important element in terms of the technological applications and how we actually integrate them into these space missions to support the well-being of astronauts and cosmonauts. Beyond that, how can we bring nature to astronauts and cosmonauts will be important. One area that we're focusing on is extraordinary and expansive landscapes, and this idea in eco-psychology that nature can be restorative and not just direct access to nature, passive access to nature as well. So in virtual reality setups, restorative being can calm the body down, regulate the body and the nervous system to a homeostatic sort of state. And so that can be a positive thing. So we know that, and how can we translate that into virtual reality or extended reality applications? So that's really where I came in with the overview effect. The main area of focus for us is using these expansive, amazing footage of space and Earth and translating that into these sort of simulations that are powerful because they're combined with music, the science of music. They're combined with, for example, Buddhist meditation, narratives, and all of that together. Then what we do is use that in specific ways to target certain emotions, the elicitation of certain emotions. So some of our programs might be more calming, bringing down the nervous system, calming down the nervous system, and some of them might be a bit more stimulating. So some of our programs are focused more on eliciting awe, so they may be a bit more of a journey, as to say. But I think that would be important. Your podcast is about space exploration and space well-being and with this particular show. So that's going to be important. It's not just about calming down the nervous system. We're going to need to stimulate the nervous system as well at times. And of course, perceptually, we need to keep travelers engaged as well. Again, the science of color is really important in this, in terms of how we use color to help people do that, and pulses and lights and all of these things. And all of that can be provided within a virtual reality application or within an extended reality application where, for example, we may integrate it into the vessel or on the habitat to really try to bring that experience to either groups or individuals. So again, thinking about space travelers and thinking about their routine, how can we support to improve their sleep? Because as you know, sleep is disrupted on the ISS. Astronauts lose at least 2 hours of sleep. They use sleep medication, and some of them. So how can we further help them improve their sleep to calm down their nervous system or relax themselves before they go to sleep? How can we improve or enhance meal times? Because again, we know that astronauts' appetites are suppressed, their senses in terms of taste and their preferences in terms of meals, that's all affected. Is there a way we can use programs like this to enhance or support that? And is there a way we can use programs like this to bring teams together to help social cohesion and team cohesion and really support that? Is there a way we can use these types of programs for enjoyment? And so really trying to think of multi-purpose applications that you can use in a way that really support some of the limitations of these types of missions and flights. And so we are just one company and one idea amongst others who are trying to do the same thing to provide solutions. But the overview effect is one idea that we've tapped into this sort of extraordinary expansive landscape idea that really is looking into transcendence, actually. And that's going back to the psychedelics and transcendence, which is where I first started on my psychology journey. Transcendence will be important on these missions as well. So what we're doing is using expansive and extraordinary landscapes as a potential trigger for controlled transcendent states within virtual reality simulations. So if we can create that, I think that will be very important on these long-term missions and trips. And transcendence, although is a term that is controversial, actually all it means is reduction in self-salience, which is ego, and an increase in connectedness. So if we just really formulate it in that simple definition, you can see how transcendence can be important for these types of missions as well.
It's interesting because just a moment ago, you had also brought up the psychology of crew dynamics. Just from an outside observer's standpoint, I at least have not come across a ton of research around the psychology of crew dynamics. So how does that factor into your work, your research, and how should we really be thinking about what might be some of the areas that we need to focus our time and effort into researching right now to better understand both from a long duration mission standpoint, I'm thinking Mars, how we go about selecting and organizing that first crew and kind of what we need that team to be in order to function efficiently.
There's been many psychologists, space psychologists, who have looked at the not just the salutogenic benefits of spaceflight, but really broken down some of these factors in relation to crew dynamics and selection training, as well as the actual crew dynamics when people are on a mission. And I think there are many factors that can support that. So, for example, personality factors like flexibility, being open to new experiences, having some sort of personality that doesn't maybe overreact to things. I think things like that are a go-to in terms of what they're looking for. But also, I think something that is less often mentioned is things like humor. You know, people being able to make light of things sometimes and being able to joke around. And I know that on the ISS, for example, that has been a very important thing for people to be able to laugh and joke together in such an extreme environment when you're completely confined and isolated. And also, I suppose there is something about in-group and out-group. So there's a psychologist called Henry Tajfel, who, you know, I think in the 70s talks about this, and there's been lots of research since. But he talks about this idea that the more homogeneous a group is, there will be less arguments and less disagreements in that group, as opposed to a group which is more varied and has a sort of mix of people from different beliefs, cultures, and backgrounds. And that's controversial to say, but there is room for more disagreement when we come from different systems and beliefs and values and backgrounds. But that doesn't mean to say that we should exclude people and have just, you know, one group of people with one belief system there. but it is important to factor in decision-making and in training in order to remain aware of that, because under stressful conditions, we are going to be more prone to overreact. We might experience illusions, delusions, we might become paranoid, we might respond in a way that we wouldn't usually respond. Therefore, these differences might be heightened more. I think it was in the Biodome 2 experiments that they did that this really played out in a strong way, where there was a real division in the group and people formed in and out groups. And that really was a demonstration of how this in-group and out-group bias can manifest within teams and within all of us. You know, in day-to-day encounters when we work in a team, you've probably observed it. I know I have, where people do form judgments and people can gravitate towards what they're familiar to as opposed to the things that or the people that they're less familiar with. So it's important to provide training, because I know that now we're moving towards an era of inclusivity. We're moving towards an era of trying to bring people together and trying to give access to all people to be able to one day make these flights and take these journeys. But I do think that that needs to be considered.
What types of tests or studies can we perform in analog habitats to better answer some of those questions related to psychology of space travel, related to crew dynamics and just general astronaut space traveler mental health?
There are specific psychological measures and tests that are used. Of course, NASA uses, as well as analog missions. And I think that's a very important point in terms of, for training, certainly, how we can put people into analog stations on Earth to assess how they respond within a team and to think about the structure and schedule of the day and what they're doing and how we can bring teams together through scheduling and through how we plan their routines. I know, for example, in some analogs in Antarctica, they are very specific in how they plan because of the day and night cycles and lack of daylight and all of the rest of it. They really plan certain activities that the crew can do together. It might just be fetching water or something like that, that brings the crew together. That is something, for example, vital that they're doing that is necessary and important. Of course, some of those can be automated or might not actually require the crew to go and get that water. It might be not necessary, but it is factored in so it can bring the crew together. And so similarly, in terms of bringing astronauts and cosmonauts together on these missions, I think factoring in, and as they have done, factoring in activities that they can participate in as a team, as a group, I think will be important. And let's say on a Martian environment, what can they do as a team together? And it might be survival things, it might be leisurely activities, but it's important in bringing everyone together.
So I also want to go back to something that you had brought up kind of at the beginning of this interview. But you had mentioned kind of navigating that sense of disconnection. So could you maybe walk us through, in your opinion, how does that sense of disconnection vary based on whether you're viewing the Earth from orbit, from the lunar surface, perhaps the lunar underground in a lava tube, or much more further out on Mars?
What we do know is our senses rely on objects in our environment to make sense of the world. Our brain is in an enclosed darkness within our skulls and is reliant on the sensory information that is fed back on the objects in our environment. And then our brain interprets that and makes mental models of what it thinks those objects are. So it's an estimating machine. It's sort of just guessing what's out there. So a lot of it is built on these models that the brain has developed from our interactions, our time on Earth. So that's important. Object relations is important. So we take a guess at when we're in orbit or when we're on the moon, we can still see the Earth. So that, I think, will be very powerful because that will be home. That's where we, certainly for early travelers who are just traveling there and coming back, that's their home. That's where they belong. It's providing a source of sensory information, but also that sort of sense of nostalgia, that sense of that's where my family are. That's where everything I know is. That's where I come from. That sense of kind of identity. As you're going further out and the Earth is becoming smaller and smaller and you are in a semi-mechanical environment, you are being exposed to, I call them objects in psychology, you call it object relations. You are being exposed to objects in the environment that your senses, your perceptual modulation systems, your psyche, nothing is familiar. And nothing will be familiar because you're in expansive space. It will take a long time for our human psyche to adjust and adapt to that kind of environment. So as you're going, the place that is familiar, the thing that you know, the place that you identify with, and all of the objects of interaction within it are going to become more and more distant. So I think the salutogenesis is about this continuum of sort of, if you think about salutogenesis as health enhancing, you know, things that are health promoting. And on the other end are things that are destabilizing, that can trigger disease, that can bring about disease. So disease on one end and health on one end. And we're constantly going sort of back and forth as human beings between these two poles. So everything that you're doing, if you have too much stress, you go towards the disease and destabilization end. If you are doing the things that are healthy and eating well and drinking enough fluids and have good social connections and, you know, your mind's in a good place, you're moving more towards a health side. So you can imagine in this very stressful environment where everything that you know of and everything that you identify with, everything that you rely on perceptually is moving further and further away, that can really be stressful, and the stress can activate responses that veer you more towards the disease or destabilization end of that pole. That's important to consider in terms of the psychological impact. Again, which highlights it's very important to try to find ways to help people cope. In terms of this human psyche, I think, again, thinking of all of the myths and mythologies, I mean, it's not just the objects of attachment and objects of interaction, but it's also all the myths and mythologies that we know. Many of them relate to terrestrial settings. The stories and narratives that we tell ourselves, many of them are based about terrestrial worlds and settings and objects. And so that removal of all of these normal reference points that we rely on can have an effect on the psychology, mental health, and psyche of a human being. So you can think of from a psychological perspective, if you don't have those things at hand, that can lead to, in the best case scenarios, some illusional abnormalities that can come around, some perceptual abnormalities, might increase anxiety. But it can, in worst case scenarios, it can lead to psychiatric outcomes. The basis of many of psychological issues, for example, social anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, health anxiety, these are things that I deal with more on a day-to-day basis, by the way. They have fear, the basis of all of them. So if you're in a stressful environment and you're faced with a landscape that is unfamiliar, that is dangerous, that is extreme, all familiar reference points are being removed, all points of identification are being removed, all points of familiar perceptual interaction are being, or most are being removed, then that can veer you towards that state of destabilization and longer term disease. And so again, it's important to have the right training. It's important to have the right applications and ecosystems in place to help people cope with that from a psychological perspective. Now, when you go on Mars, I think that's even just, it's a fascinating area. And I've thought about this, I'm sure, as you have, Britt, in terms of how this will impact people. The question was more about Earth and disconnection that people feel. So I can't really explain what will happen, but my guess is that on the early settlers, so it depends who's going out there, right? Is it going to be a 3-year mission? Is it a flyby mission? Is it habitation mission, a permanent mission? But let's say a habitation mission. So the first, let's say, 250 people that go out there, that's the right population size, and we figured that out. And we're going to send 250 people on a starship, and they're going to go to Mars, and we've set up some inflatable domes or whatever, and they're going to be living there. I think that for those people, are they Martians? Are they Earthlings? They're Earthlings because they've been born on Earth, they've lived on Earth, so their point of attachment will be still Earth, and their point of reference will still be Earth. Their celebrations that they've become accustomed to will come from Earth. Their family will still be on Earth, and Earth will be a disc in the cosmic sky, and they'll be on a landscape which is completely different to most places on Earth. So I think that there is a risk that they will experience extreme sense of disconnection. And of course, connection is at the heart of mental health, not just social connection, but connection to the natural environment, connection to our families, connection to our narratives and beliefs and all of these things. Connection is at the heart of everything in mental health. And so disconnection can really aggravate certain scenarios. That doesn't mean to say that will happen or that we can't support them in that transition. You know, we've lived on Earth and we've come through many adversities as a species. You know, we were nomads, and then we've gone through sort of this hunter-gatherer kind of experience, and where we're moving around and we're fighting for our survival. And then we've had this sort of period of industrialization. We've had lots of different sort of transitions here on Earth. So we're very adaptive and adjustable as a species. But I do think that this will need to be considered very carefully. So again, if we're doing habitation programs, when that time comes, whenever that is, we will need to factor in who's going, how they're going to manage these big differences in lifestyle, in how they connect, in what they do, in their activities, how they find meaning. That's another important driver to well-being, you know, our sense of purpose and meaning. What will happen to them when these sort of everyday earthly stimuli and activities and sources of comfort and meaning are removed? I don't have the answers, but I think there will need to be interventions, applications, training and more in order to establish a healthy early population that can adjust and adapt. There will also be exciting things on places like Mars, you know, that they can really, we talked about Martians or Earthlings. How do we help people take on board the identity of the new environment that they're in? And that will be important in terms of acclimatization, thinking about where they're in, the location they're at, what they're doing, the environment they're in, and how they can find new sources of meaning, develop new stories and narratives and belief structures potentially based on that environment. Because of course, everything we have, all of our norms, all of our belief structures, all of the rituals, all of the ways we engage are based on our environment here on Earth. They developed out of this close, intimate bond and interaction that we have with the Earth. And similarly, new ones will develop when we're out there, I'm sure, alongside new currencies, new economic systems, new religions, new whatever else will be developed. But it's a fascinating area to think about.
Yeah, certainly many topics and areas of research to support that first mission to Mars and all the subsequent ones that I'm sure will be planned as well. So this is our final question before the lightning round. We ask this of everyone that comes on the podcast. But Celestial Citizen is all about the idea that humans can become not only better stewards of Earth, but also better interplanetary citizens. In your opinion, what is one important way in which people can work toward becoming celestial citizens today?
I think this idea of connecting with nature is not just about our immediate nature in our environment. Nature is about the extensive environment as well, which includes the cosmos and includes all these other planets. And I think a return back to our roots of connecting with this extensive space in a much more deep and meaningful way. So the immediate natural environment, Earth, and all of the things that it provides, but also space, the cosmos, all these other planets, and how they have played a role in our beginnings, in our origin story, and how they continue to play a role. The other day I read that Martian meteorites, 3% are from Mars, you know, small rocks and stones and meteorites that get through our atmosphere. And that's amazing, because that's something that's been coming over all of those millions of light years away to us, and that we're kind of just connected in many ways. And the effect of the moon on tides. And so the planetary systems affect us every day, and just really bringing the outside in more and expressing gratitude, compassion. But also this story has stayed with me, and remembering that these planets, so let's just talk about the rocky planets within the inside of the solar system. So for example, Earth and Mars and Venus started their life story around the same time, and they were all at one point likely to have been planets that were habitable or with temporal conditions, good temperatures that can support life. And I think that's a remarkable story that these siblings somehow started their journey the same. Earth is the only one can cater for life as we know it. So I think these types of stories, especially now that, you know, with the James Webb satellite and all the work from the space agencies, are really bringing space to us in a much more profound way. And that's so exciting because it can contribute to us expanding our consciousness in a very positive and meaningful way, where we are not any longer just thinking of the small self, but beyond. And the other point is coming together, I think celestial citizens, plural, coming together. Human beings, when they work together, are remarkable. And I am continuously blown away of these initiatives when people come together and work together for the good of this goal and put their differences aside to achieve something meaningful in the world.
I think that's a great take-home message. I really think that's a powerful way that we can encourage everyone to live their life. And also thinking about, as you said, coming together to tackle some of these very big challenges that exist for us, both on Earth and in space. This episode of Celestial Citizen Podcast is in part sponsored by the Colorado School of Mines Space Resources Program. This first-of-its-kind interdisciplinary program offers certificate, Master of Science, and PhD degrees for professionals around the world interested in the emerging field of extraterrestrial resources. The program focuses on developing core knowledge and design practices for effective and responsible identification, extraction, and use of resources in the solar system to enhance space exploration and enable the new space economy. To learn more about the Mines Space Resources Program, educational opportunities, and research activities, check out its webpage at space.mines.edu. Thank you again to the Colorado School of Mines Space Resources Program for your sponsorship this year. Okay, so we are going to try the lightning round now. It's a little different. So lightning round is basically going to be quick questions. You can either give a brief explanation or no explanation at all, just your answer. Are you ready?
I hope so.
Would you rather live on the moon or Mars?
The moon.
On the moon, your favorite space hobby would be what?
Space juggling.
Oh, I imagine that'd be a bit easier, right, than on Earth?
Think so. Yes, I'm a terrible juggler, yes.
What job would you have on the moon?
I'd be a transcendent clerk.
Oh, what is that? I know this is the lightning round, but I'm just kind of, I'm curious.
Oh, that just came to me, a transcendent clerk. I would help people reach transcendent states.
Oh.
But that's the fun job. A human factor specialist would be the, you know, down the line answer. But yeah.
Very cool. All right. Favorite book about space, could be fiction or nonfiction?
So I'm reading The Space Race, which is a bit of an older one. It's a couple of years old. That's pretty good. It's a good sort of all-rounder of, you know, the space race and what's going on. And I'm really enjoying it. And it's got these snippets from NASA and audios and narrations, clips, so it really makes it quite interactive. And a bit sort of more psychology-based, so any book by Aya Whitley or Nick Canis, all of those are great. James Lovelock, Gaia Theory is another good one to look up. And obviously The Overview Effect.
Oh, yes. Goes without saying. Yeah, goes without saying, of course. I think that's on just about everybody's shelf in the space community. But yeah, those are great, great choices. Okay, your favorite space TV show or movie?
Movie's got to be 2001 Space Odyssey. I never get bored of it. I never get bored of it. You know, I didn't watch it for like 7 years, and I went round a family member's house, and it was in this sort of like old DVD collection and I put it on and I was like, this is amazing still after all these years.
Can I tell you what though? And this is interesting because this is a conversation about psychology, but that movie gives me so much anxiety. Like the second half, it's so much anxiety that I can't watch it without getting like sweaty palms. Like I just can't.
It's quite shocking towards the end. It takes you on a very surreal journey.
Yeah, like even now, I'm not really sure I understand like the final portion of that movie. Like I'm not sure that I fully get it.
I don't think many people do. I've read reviews that are trying to still figure out, you know, the meaning. Yeah, it's similar to Interstellar in some ways.
I've talked to people who have said that that gives them anxiety too. But for me, for whatever reason, Interstellar, I didn't feel anxiety. I just felt like, I guess, these feelings of awe that we're discussing here. But yeah, with 2001, I definitely have some anxiety. And it's funny because actually, on the Continuum podcast episode that at the time of this recording just came out today, I was talking with Mekhli Karol. We were having a conversation and we always do this like fun segment at the end where we have ChatGPT generate some questions for us. Well, one of the questions that ChatGPT generated was like a what if scenario where it was basically like your AI spaceship turns against you or it becomes obsessed with you. And I was like, AI wrote that. And it totally freaked me out. And then I had flashbacks to 2001 and I was like, nope. I was like closing the computer now. This is too real. I got to stop.
Right now, that's a particular concern for sure with all of the ChatGPT developments and AI developments, right? It could happen.
I know. Yeah. So flashbacks to HAL 9000, but...
So I think Interstellar as well, definitely more modern take. I saw that in the cinema and it just blew me away. Absolutely. And the music was just music breathtaking.
I think it was like Hans Zimmer, right? Yeah, such a beautiful film. I'd really love to see that come back on IMAX and like get released to theaters or something. That'd be cool.
Gravity as well.
Oh, you have so many controversial picks. Gravity is it's contentious. Yeah, on here. Because sometimes I ask people what the worst space movie is and so many people dislike Gravity. The other one, what is it called? The other one that is a really controversial space film, Ad Astra, that's what it was. I feel like it had some interesting scenes like that, you know, kind of like, I don't know, like moon buggy race scene or whatever was interesting. But then, yeah, it did move pretty slow. But the other thing is that I just feel like it was so negative the way it ended. So I think that also kind of harkens back to my question here earlier on in this conversation around like, sometimes I wonder if like as more and more just everyday people, civilians go to space, I mean, there's bound to be people that feel like they feel this inherent like sort of emptiness or maybe a negative feeling about how vast the universe is, right? Because that can be kind of anxiety provoking. But I feel like some of those movies take such a dark spin on space. So it's hard.
They do.
Hard not to walk away with that.
It's true. It's very true. And it would be good to see something a bit more uplifting moving forward into the future. What are your favorites?
I mean, Interstellar kind of was what inspired me to get involved in the space industry in the first place. So that one's definitely high on my list. I love Contact.
It is a space movie for sure, but it's more extraterrestrial oriented. But yes, I would have said Contact. That's why I'm saying that.
Well, Moon. I love Moon. I mean, talk about a psychological thriller too.
Oh, really? I've not seen that.
Oh, yeah, you got to see Moon. Moon might be like one of my favorites. I mean, nothing can really like take the place of Interstellar for me, but Moon is really good. And then Clara. Not a lot of people have seen this. It came out in 2018 and it was like a small little indie film. It was all about like an astrophysicist that was doing exoplanet research. And I don't want to give away any spoilers. At the heart of it, I mean, it's a real like love story, right? But it was actually super interesting. And I feel like nobody knows about it or talks about it.
I'm going to look it up and if it's suitable, I'll watch it with my daughter. So that would be great.
It's been a couple years, so I'd have to rethink all the scenes in that one. But anyway, let's see. Something most people don't know about you.
I used to travel to space in my imagination all the time when I was a little girl, but there's nothing that, you know, I'm sort of relatively boring. I'm sort of a mum, a psychologist, and everyone knows that. And, you know, everyone knows the work I'm doing with space, and I've traveled a bit, and that's quite boring. So everyone knows that. So yeah, I'm trying to think, I'm pretty boring. That's just reassured me that I'm quite boring.
Well, you know what? It's kind of like this lightning round. It always puts people on the spot. So, you know, I feel like it's tough. It's tough to come up with these.
I've listened to your podcast. I know the questions you ask. I should have come prepared. But anyway, yeah, there we go.
I know. Before next season, I'm going to like change it up just to see. It's always fun because we always like to see, like, you know, in our summary episode, like how people responded all, you know, kind of next to each other. It's exciting. Okay. Let's see here. You get the opportunity to live off Earth temporarily. Would you rather live underground, on the surface, or in an orbiting space station?
Initially, underground, I would say, my practical mind.
Radiation defense, that's good. Yeah.
And then I think once we've got the drones and the systems all set up, some overground modular system, I think will be realistic. I don't think we should have high rises off world. I've seen some designs. You've probably seen some designs. I don't like of those.
Fun to imagine, but in reality, yeah.
It makes sense, I suppose, from your expertise, Britt. It saves space. You're going up. I'm sure there's lots of other benefits to it as well, but it just doesn't look great, does it?
No, yeah. No, that's true. I also feel like there's a real like commitment to domes, like dome shapes. And I don't know. I mean, in some respect, there's a place for some of these different structures and designs, but I'm always intrigued to see just how many people are like, space must mean dome. And that's kind of like what they gravitate towards, no pun intended.
I nearly did say biodome. So that's when I was like, some kind of modular system, because I was actually thinking about the discussion that you and I had. How do you extend this habitat out, right? So if you originally, initially have 100 people there, or you need to kind of think about the bigger picture. And that's really inspired me, actually, reading your website and trying to think about that bigger picture of actually it's not just the starting point, it's also where you want to end up as well.
It's something that I feel like I wish a lot more people were talking about, is that we don't really have a good plan for how to design in an adaptable and expandable way, because that's going to be really critical, right? I mean, we've already seen this play out terrestrially to a certain extent, whereas if we don't have a good plan for how that like initial center expands, then what we get on Earth, we got sprawl. I think that that's something we definitely need to consider, and especially because transportation in space is not easy either, very far from it. So I think that's definitely something we'll have to contend with as we start to plan out what that first community might look like. Okay, let's see. You are sent on a long duration mission. What's more important, choosing your crew, choosing the food, or choosing the destination?
Destination. It's destination. I think I could pretty much get along with most people. Yeah, where I'm going, I think that'll be an important one.
Yeah, you got to know. It's context framing for sure. Okay, and then here's our last one. Finish this sentence. In 50 years, we'll all be what?
We'll all be transcendent beings.
Oh, I like it. Yes, well, I think that that's a great way to close out today's conversation. Anahita, thank you so much for joining Celestial Citizen Podcast and helping us navigate the very fascinating world of space psychology and the intersection of the overview effect and mental health. So thank you so much for your time today.
3, 2, 1. We have liftoff.
You on a little trip, my supersonic ship's at your disposal if you feel so inclined. Alright. Go travel faster than light. That little Elon Musk will be left in the dust, so alright. Say alright!
And to our community of Celestial Citizens, thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Celestial Citizen Podcast. This episode would not be possible without the terrific work of this show's editor, Victor Figueroa. Thank you, Victor. Also, a very special thank you to Graham Clark, who created the amazing intro and outro music for this podcast.
All right.
If you're interested in learning more about Celestial Citizen, and I hope you are, then check out celestialcitizen.com. You can also follow along on Twitter at Celestial Citizen and Instagram at The Celestial Citizen. And be sure to sign up for Continuum, Celestial Citizen's newsletter on Substack. If you're interested in supporting the mission of Celestial Citizen, you can always reach out to learn more about opportunities to sponsor or become a patron of this podcast.
Round and round on my supersonic rocket ship. Let me take you on a little trip. My supersonic ship's at your disposal if you feel so inclined. Alright. Nobody's gonna travel second class. There'll be equality and no suppression of minorities.
A major component of Celestial Citizen is feedback and public participation. We want to hear what you have to say. So let us know what you think about humanity's future in space and what it should look like. Please share your voice and your unique perspective on social media. Or if you prefer, all of the Celestial Citizen articles can also be found on Medium. So drop a comment and join the conversation. If you love today's podcast, please have your friends and family subscribe on whatever device or platform you listen to podcasts on, and leave a stellar review so others can get hooked as well. That's all for now, Celestial Citizens. I'll be back next week for another episode. In the meantime, don't be afraid to take up space.